Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, two area Eagle Scouts with noteworthy projects honoring military veterans. But up front, underfunded and polluted, solutions to fund clean water in Pennsylvania and the Chesapeake Bay watershed is the title of a report by the environmental organization Penn Future. And the title may say it all. It's a comprehensive report that focuses more on what Pennsylvania can do to clean up waterways and reduce pollution than on the bay itself. It includes recommendations for how to deal with nutrients, stormwater runoff, and hiring more environmental personnel. Joining us on today's program are Ezra Thrush, Senior Director of Government Affairs, and Renee Reber, Campaign Manager, Watershed Advocacy with Penn Future. Welcome to the program. Now, Renee Reber, let me start with you. This report is somewhat different than others before it in that it does focus more on the watershed rather than the bay itself. Obviously, what happens here in Pennsylvania impacts the bay. But why go this route?
Well, Scott, thanks for having us on this morning. And you're absolutely right. Our local waterways are important to the economy, are important to Pennsylvanians. Many, if not, 90% of Pennsylvanians do support investments in conservation and clean water. And when you look at the state as a whole, drill down to the Chesapeake or the Susquehanna and the Potomac River sheds in the central part of the state draining to the Chesapeake. But when you look at the state as a whole, one-third of our streams are not meeting the standards that they are because due to water pollution. So, when you look in the Susquehanna Basin and the Potomacs in the central part, that's 15,000 miles of streams. So this report is really looking at what the legislature can do to make those investments to clean up our local waterways, because we're also gonna see the benefits at home as well.
Okay, what are those benefits at home? Because, one of the questions I always ask when we have this conversation about Chesapeake Bay is whether Pennsylvanians realize that we're not just talking about a bay that is located in Maryland and Virginia, but that the waterways in Pennsylvania are impacted.
That's absolutely correct. First and foremost, this affects our recreation opportunities, right? And that's from everybody who's getting out on the water and recreating, either swimming or fishing or boating, whatever your recreation pleasure is on the water. Or those folks that are making money from those recreation jobs, nature-based jobs. Our drinking water, a large source of our drinking water is coming from our rivers and streams. So the efforts that we spend to clean up our waterways will help reduce the cost of drinking water cleanup as well. Industries use the water as well, and that's also important. And one of the things, one of the larger sources of pollution it's the number one in our waterways, it's the biggest area that these efforts are trying to address is the runoff coming from our agricultural fields. So I think that state investments to our farmers, to our landowners, can really go a long way. These investments can improve the soil health, the health of the farms, the health of the cattle, the cows, the herd, and really benefit our farmers as well. I'd also say that it benefits our communities in addition, because our communities suffer from flooding events, right? And this is both our streams overflowing from heavy rain events, but this is also street flooding as well. So efforts that we can do to manage our stormwaters in our community will help keep our community safer from flooding events.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you just ticked down through the list, and I don't know whether you did this on purpose or not, but starting with recreation, when we're talking about drinking water, when we're talking about flooding, those are things that could have an impact on the health of Pennsylvanians. Recreation is great. I mean, we all want to do it on the water here in Pennsylvania or on the bay, wherever, but those where people's lives could be impacted, especially when climate change is put into the equation as well, I'd think that that would get a lot of people's attention.
You're absolutely right. You know, the public health aspects of our clean water are such an important part. And even with when you go back to the recreation, right, that's a super important part of our physical and our mental health both. You know, during the pandemic, when folks couldn't go around and be social with each other like we want to do, right? Our parks experienced such a huge increase in use, right? Because people were looking for that as a place to go and to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm. So Ezra Thrush, you know, as I said, the title of your report may describe, it's just a perfect description of what you're recommending here, underfunded and polluted. Let's start with polluted. How would you describe Pennsylvania's waterways right now?
You know, I would describe Pennsylvania's waterways are really not safe. And because about 30% of the waterways are impaired, it's not safe for fishing, drinking, swimming for the most part. I do know that, you know, a lot of Pennsylvanians really enjoy the streams, creeks, and rivers. I grew up spending hours upon hours in the Potomac River Basin in southern Pennsylvania, crayfishing and fishing with my family. And that brings back lots of fond memories. And I know a lot of Pennsylvanians really rely on angling and rely on that part of life for enjoyment and for sustenance. And what I would say is that there are a lot of challenges with Pennsylvania's waterways right now, but I don't think, you know, the challenges outweigh the opportunities we have ahead. I think there are a lot of lots of room for improvement, and Pennsylvanians should certainly make sure that their voices are heard by their state legislators and folks in Harrisburg, make sure that they know that clean water is important to them, especially given where we are today on the calendar. You know, we're in June, which is typically budget season at the state government. It's important at this time, as we start to talk about the budget as a moral document for our legislators, that they remember that clean water is essential for a number of reasons. And clean water is not a partisan issue, but something that all Pennsylvanians cherish and we have to make sure we value as we put our state budget together the next several weeks.
A moral document. Haven't heard the state budget described that way very often. What do you mean by a moral document?
Yeah, it's an old political science term of art, I guess you would say. But the idea is that, you know, the state budget or the federal government budget, for instance, shows what the values of the government is, right? So you can look at a budget and tell where folks think money should be spent. And so it's a moral document, meaning that clean water, public health, public access, you know, rights that were given to Pennsylvanians through Article 1, Section 27 of the Pennsylvania Constitution, the Environmental Rights Amendment, make sure that those values are evident in the budget. And so really the budget speaks to what a state or a federal government thinks are important each year. So that's what that term really refers to.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about a recent report by Penn Future, Underfunded and Polluted Solutions to Fund Clean Water in Pennsylvania and the Chesapeake Bay Watershed. I'm going to be talking about the specific recommendations in just a moment. If you have a question or a comment for our guest, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Ezra, I'll ask you kind of the same question that I did Renee a few minutes ago, because you were talking about legislators, the budget being a moral document, realizing the importance and the rights that Pennsylvanians have to clean water, clean air, a clean environment. Do Pennsylvanians see this as important? And I hate to say more important, but, you know, the people who actually have the power to do something about it are the legislatures. So do legislators see this as an important issue?
Yeah, you know, I'll speak to the Pennsylvanians' level of support quickly and then talk about some initiatives at the General Assembly. First off, there was a poll that was just completed last fall by the Growing Greener Coalition, and it said that more than 93% of Pennsylvanians agree that funding conservation and environmental protection, even when there might be a tight state budget, is important and something that should be put forward. And that really a lot of folks across the board, Democrats, Republicans, independents, all believe that putting money behind water conservation, especially, and environmental protection is really essential. And I will mention that there is a growing sense of folks in Harrisburg that there needs to be something done. Just in the Chesapeake Bay watershed writ large, we need to be spending close to $500 million annually for watershed cleanup. And we have a gap, unfortunately, of about $325 million. You know, that basically means the last several years, the General Assembly has refused to do its job and to put money forward in an investment in the watershed cleanup. And there are a couple opportunities at hand right now that the General Assembly could fix this. I will mention that Pennsylvania is getting about $7 billion from the American Rescue Plan that they're supposed to spend and invest during this budget process. There are a couple efforts that have been introduced as co-sponsor memoranda recently in the General Assembly. One is renewing a Growing Greener 3 program, which would help increase projects out in the field for cleanup, tree buffer plantings. And this is led by Senators Gordner and Mensch. They're looking to spend about $500 million from the American Rescue Plan. Another idea put forth in the General Assembly is from Senator Yaw, who is looking to create a Clean Streams Fund, which would also use about $250 million from the American Rescue Plan. And so these are really interesting, good concepts. Looking forward to see legislature take these concepts seriously and move them forward these next several weeks. We think with the American Rescue Plan at hand, there's a big opportunity to put significant investment in conservation and environmental protection. And aside from these specific funds I had just mentioned, it's far past time that we equitably and adequately fund our agencies that work on these issues. DEP has long been underfunded. Our State Conservation Commission, the county conservation districts, and the DCNR also needs some significant funding to work on these issues if we want to put clean water in a serious light in Pennsylvania and make some real change.
Ezra, as I'm looking through the recommendation, right after number one was that personnel recommendation, adding employees to the agencies that oversee environmental issues and work in here in Pennsylvania. And you're not just talking about a dozen or so. You're talking about a fair number. The reason I brought that up about it being right after number one, is that a priority for you? And it is not very often that you have an organization, even a Pennsylvanian, say, we need to hire more state workers, but this has been an ongoing issue. I mean, this precedes the Wolf administration, during the Corbett administration, DEP, and even the governor admitted, did not have enough people. What's taking so long? And tell me about your recommendation. What specifically are you recommending?
I'll take a stab at the first few thoughts, and I'm sure my colleague Renee would have a few things to add to. And what I would say is that it really takes everybody to make a difference here, not just the public sector, but certainly public-private partnerships. The private sector is doing a lot of work in the space. I'm thinking specifically about a number of projects in Lancaster County. But certainly from the public sector, we need to get our agencies back to a robust level where they can do their jobs without just trying to keep their heads above water at any given time. our agencies just don't have the same staff that we've had in the early 2000s. We might get some significant money for projects, but if we don't have enough technical device, technical capacity, it's hard to get the projects done. So we understand that these are big numbers. We understand that it's bold. These are bold asks, but to get the work done, we really need to increase our capacity at all levels, especially with the state agencies, to help get the money to farmers, to landowners, to get inspectors and technical capacity folks out in the field doing the projects. Renee, I don't know if you have any other ideas to add to that.
Yeah, that's well put, Ezra. So the report is closely based. We looked at the state's watershed implementation plan for the Susquehanna and Potomac River basins, and that plan showed that the agencies, the Department of Environmental Protection, the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, the State Conservation Commission, Fish and Boat Commission. That they needed about 100 additional employees to get the job done. And then on the technical assistance side, it showed that we need an additional 154 technical assistance providers, mostly coming through the county conservation districts to provide that technical assistance. And you know, the projects that need to go on the ground to clean up our waterways, they can't be done without the personnel to get the job done. I'd say that making sure that we have adequate staff, adequate technical assistance is a top priority to be able to have everything in place that we need to get the job done.
Renee, let me clarify here. When Ezra mentioned, and you know, this has been documented by other agencies as well, or other organizations, I should say, that Pennsylvania is underfunding its Chesapeake Bay cleanup. When you're talking about hiring, you know, and I'm talking, it looks like you're talking roughly 200 or so employees. Is that in addition to the underfunding, or is that part of the underfunding?
That is a great question. That is a part of the equation. That is a part of the math. That is part of the underfunding. It's included in the estimates of what is needed to clean up our waterways.
Okay, so I get what I was looking for, and I think you know what I was looking for is, are we talking about on top of even a bigger deficit than has been pointed out? We're going to have more questions and comments in just a moment for our guest. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about a Penn Future report titled Underfunded and Polluted Solutions to Fund Clean Water in Pennsylvania and the Chesapeake Bay Watershed. Our guest, Ezra Thrush, who is the Senior Director of Government Affairs, and Renee Reber, Campaign Manager of Watershed Advocacy with Penn Future. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk@witf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So we talked about the recommendation for hiring more personnel. Let's move on to another recommendation. And Ezra, you had mentioned earlier, but I want to ask Renee this question about agriculture, that most of the nutrient pollution running into Pennsylvania's waterways and eventually into the bay is coming from agriculture. So what is the recommendation that you're looking for? And let me just say that, you know, over the years, there seems to have been a change in, I don't know if attitude is the right word or not, but at least a change in thinking. I think very early on, there was almost an adversarial relationship between farmers and a lot of people who wanted to clean up the bay. Now it seems like you're on the same side. So let's talk about what you're recommending when it comes to nutrients and agriculture, Renee.
Absolutely. So there are a number of different recommendations for agriculture. But at the top of the list is a program called the Agricultural Conservation and Assistance Program. In the report, we refer to this as an agricultural cost share program. And right now there is a bill out there introduced by Senator Jean Yaw. It's SB 465, as I mentioned, the Agricultural Conservation Assistance Program, or ACAP for short. And this would provide money directly to farmers and landowners to address agricultural runoff, put conservation practices on the ground. And what we like about this is that it's modeled after a successful already existing program that the State Conservation Commission already oversees. It's called the Dirt and Gravel Roads, dealing with dirt and gravel roads, right? Stormwater runoff coming from those. And so it's a great model. And so the money would go out through the county conservation districts where decisions can be made locally on the ground about where the best places are to address the runoff coming from agriculture. Senator Yaw also has a fertilizer bill that I'd like to mention, which is SB 251. And this is addressing, this is going to the lawn fertilizer, the over fertilizing of our lawns, which is a major source of pollution to our local rivers and streams. And this bill would really help curb how much fertilizer we're putting on our lawns. But there are a few other agricultural policies that we recommend as well. And it's really taking advantage of expanding upon existing programs. So one would be expanding upon Pennsylvania's Reserve Enhancement and Protection Tax Credit Program, called REAP for short. And this provides tax credits for landowners who are instituting, who are putting on the ground conservation practices. And then there's also another program called Clean and Green, which gives preferential tax assessment based on the use values and not the market values. So we recommend expanding that and also making sure that the landowners or farmers are complying with the statutes they need to be able to receive that funding. And then a more non-funding related policy that would really go a long way is giving municipalities the authority to enact local ordinances stream bank fencing requirements. And this would allow for more fences to go up, keeping cows out of the streams, which can be a huge problem. They trample the stream bank trying to get in and out, which creates a lot of sedimentation. It can hurt the health of the cow themselves. They can stumble and fall. But they do direct deposits when they are in the streams. So keeping our cows out of the streams would go a long way to cleaning up the waterways and improving health of our cows as well.
Yeah. The cows pooping in the water is not exactly the kind of thing we'd like to think about. But, you know, the problem that farmers have always had and with this issue is money. I mean, your recommendations, you're looking for where money would come from. Let's face it, for farmers over the past few years, money has been tight. Money has been tight on a lot of different fronts. I mean, many farmers, if not most, I don't know the percentage, but many farmers would like to comply because in the long run, it probably is better for them as well. But it's just been that they can, their profit margins, if they're making a profit at all, it's very difficult. You know, this is how they make their living. So are you confident that this kind of funding would help farmers be able to afford to make these moves and still make a living?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're calling for. We're calling for increased investments that would benefit our farmers, that would go out to the farms. And as I mentioned earlier, these practices can help improve the viability, can help improve the profitability of farms. They can improve things like soil health and other other factors that reduce the input cost to the farmers of farming. So it really is a win-win to invest in our farmers and clean water all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add that there really is a lot of good synthesis and synergy going on right now between non-governmental organizations, from the agriculture sector, the environmental conservation sector, and I think even government agencies. I think really largely there was a page that's been turned, I want to say maybe in 2016, 2017, with the beginning of the third phase of the watershed implementation plan for the Chesapeake cleanup. Really, groups are acting more as partners with farmers and not being adversarial. Scott, as you had mentioned earlier, and we're all trying to think about this big picture. How can we move forward? Let's be solutions oriented. Let's come alongside farmers and landowners and look for the way forward. And a lot of that speaks to funding. Funding is just the big nut to crack. And there are a lot of options out there for the General Assembly to raise revenue. I know some thoughts that I've heard are maybe removing the state tax exemption on bottled waters, coffees, juices, teas, trying to increase the tipping fee on garbage that comes to Pennsylvania, and maybe that would generate some dollars for conservation. There are a lot of different revenue options that we call for in our report that are already on the table in the General Assembly. We just need action by the General Assembly now to move us forward. And I'll just add, the federal government has a piece to this as well. We advocate every 4 or 5 years when the Farm Bill of the United States, the Congress puts together, we advocate for strong conservation dollars that comes back and can be spent for farmers and landowners to do buffer planting and maintenance, and really making sure that farmers have a hand up as they work on the conservation practices here.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to another recommendation, and if I could put it as simple as can be, it is plant more trees. Now, you do have some specific plans there for planting more trees, but this is one area that a lot of people, at least an observation of my part, seems as though a lot of people have embraced and have tried to do what they can. Ezra, what about that? Are Pennsylvanians planting more trees along streams? And what recommendations does this plan make?
Yeah, so we do need to plant more trees in Pennsylvania. One of our largest challenges in Pennsylvania, and you know, I've heard this many times from Secretary Cindy Adams done at the DCNR, is that our biggest problem is just retention, forest retention. And a lot of the problem with uprooting trees, cutting trees down, is that the sedimentation and erosion causes the problems and dirtying our streams, creeks, and rivers. But if we keep those trees in place and we plant even more trees, we're going to have cleaner water and we're going to have cooler water. And so for all my friends who like the trout fish out there, that means buckets of trout fish. And that's really important. And it's cleaner water for us. So we need to keep more trees in place. We also need to plant more trees. I think there are a number of municipalities around the state that are doing a really good job at this. And the state agencies partnering with local townships, municipalities, non-governmental organizations are doing some great work in this space. I'll just add that we're really supportive of another piece of legislation that's been introduced from Representative Joe Webster. It's House Bill 714. And what this bill does is it just increases the buffer requirements along stream banks, and it changes it to 250 feet along the stream banks, which would just increase the amount of foliage and shrubs that help soak up and absorb any problems before it gets to the streams, creeks, and rivers. So trees are really important. And I know at the federal government level, planting trees is also really important. I know the Biden administration, along with the Department of Interior and Agriculture and EPA, they're working on a 30 by 30 initiative, and making sure that we plant more trees across Pennsylvania would really be super beneficial for all of us.
You know, I'm thinking about what you said about Secretary Dunn talking about tree removal. You know, lumber, we know the lumber industry was, really big here in Pennsylvania at one time. It still is to a degree, but not what it was at one time. And I don't, I'm not an expert on this, but I would think that a lot of trees being removed today, other than for lumber, have to do with, invasive species. That, so many trees are being killed by ash borer and other invasive species. Is that accurate, Ezra?
Yeah, I would say that's one of the factors. I would also add urban sprawl and warehouses and just development writ large across the state. growing out into our, you know, out into our wilderness, if you will, our forests and our farmlands that have been protected or haven't had development for a long time, all of a sudden are getting more impact and more development from the cities growing out. So I know just in the Cumberland Valley, for instance, there are a lot of warehouses that have been put in the last 5 to 10 years, and those used to be big forests. And so there are certainly environmental impacts from that kind of work.
We only have a few minutes left. Renee, I'm not going to get to all the recommendations here, but stormwater runoff in municipalities. I mean, this is something that, you know, when Ezra was talking a few minutes ago about urban sprawl, paving streets, stormwater, you know, all those things come into play here. What can municipalities do, and what is your what does this report recommend when it comes to stormwater runoff?
A great question. Yeah. So, you know, municipalities can put in place practices that help reduce or slow down the runoff. So we really like to advocate for green stormwater infrastructure. And those are the practices that are kind of mimicking nature, if you will, the green practices that help capture our stormwater runoff and slow it down or filter it into the ground. So examples of that could be something like a native plant rain garden where the water can pool and the plants can help soak up the water or help it infiltrate into the ground. I know we talked about riparian buffers, but urban trees, suburban trees, street trees, that's also another important green stormwater infrastructure practice. But I think, you know, one thing that we'd like to see is the development of a municipal stormwater assistance program. And this I kind of think of, I talked a bit about the farmer cost share bill earlier that Senator Yaw has introduced. And I see this as kind of a companion idea to that, where we're providing cost support to our municipalities to help them address stormwater infrastructure and needs. And another one would just be to develop there's no green stormwater infrastructure grant program devoted just to green stormwater infrastructure. So that would be another recommendation in the report. And then the state has Act 167 Stormwater Management Plan. And when we go back to talking about agency funding, this is one of those areas that got cut out of the budget a while ago. And I really would like to see this refunded, because this would help address stormwater across the Commonwealth, making sure that municipalities have ordinances in place that are dealing with stormwater runoff. And again, and I think we're getting close to our time, and I could go on further, but I'll turn it back over to you.
Again, with climate change, it's not just coastal areas that are going to have to deal with this issue. Everything is probably going to change, even inland. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Ezra Thrush is Senior Director of Government Affairs. Renee Reber is Campaign Manager of Watershed Advocacy with Penn Future. And that report, we do have a link on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Two Central Pennsylvania teenagers have achieved Scouting's highest award, the Eagles rank of Eagle Scout, tackling big projects and in one case earning national recognition. Scout Casey Essick of Mount Holly Springs in Cumberland County, Boy Scout Troop 170, was recognized recently for his efforts to honor veterans' grave sites in a Mount Holly cemetery. Through painstaking research, he discovered the cemetery held the remains of service members from 7 wars, many not properly marked with flag holders. Eagle Scout Chris Adam of Mechanicsburg also focused his project on veterans and recognizes the contributions of America's greatest generation during World War II on D-Day. Adam was selected for the Glenn A. and Melinda W. Adams National Eagle Scout Service Project of the Year Award for 2020 for the memorial called Liberation Point. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Chris Adam I'm going to start with you. Your Eagle Scout project is on the scale of what museums or cities do for their parks or memorials. The final product is Liberation Point, that is now at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center in Carlisle. It honors those who were part of the D-Day landing in Normandy during World War II. How'd you get the idea for this?
I got the idea for this when I was in my eighth grade honors history class. We were wrapping up for the year. It was around this time, and my teacher asked everyone in the class who knew what D-Day was to raise their hands. I found it quite appalling that I was one out of three students, again, in an honors history class out of the 25 people that actually knew about it and knew about the sacrifices of the greatest generation and what they gave for our freedoms and things like that. And so around that time, I was getting ready to start my Eagle Scout project. And so I decided, hey, these guys really need to they need to be recognized by our generation so that their sacrifices aren't forgotten. And so from there, I just kind of took it and ran with it.
What grade are you in now?
I am currently a rising senior at Trinity High School, so I just finished up my junior year.
A rising senior at Trinity High School. Okay. So what did you want to do with this project? What was your goal?
My goal with this project, like I said, was to really memorialize and honor the veterans from D-Day or from World War II, but specifically D-Day. I feel like it really should be something that more people from my generation know about. Not a lot of people are educated on it. And so that was kind of the base of my project. I really wanted it to be something that you could visit and learn something about D-Day when you went there. So like the theme of the project is education, obviously, because it's at the Army Heritage and Education Center. So there are educational boards there that you can go and learn things about D-Day, about each one of the five different beaches. And then, you know, like an overall kind of get like an overall understanding and knowledge of what D-Day was, but it's also in a very simple sense so that anyone from, you know, like a fourth or fifth grader could understand it. If these guys were willing to give up, you know, their teenage lives to go and fight in Normandy, France, and face an enemy, then, you know, could face losing in their lives in some cases, then I could definitely be someone to honor them. So, yeah.
So describe the structure itself that is now at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center.
So what the structure is, Liberation Point, the centerpiece of it are two bronze statues of American soldiers raiding the beaches, specifically Omaha Beach. Surrounding that, there is sand or like a gravel that represents sand so that you can kind of get the sense that you're on the beaches with the soldiers when they're running up. Around that, there's a granite pentagon. The five sides of the pentagon represent the five beachheads in Normandy. So obviously one for each one of the beachheads. Around that, there's a concrete walkway so you can walk around and get a full 360-degree view of the statues and like the sand and everything. Also, I forgot to mention, inside the sand, in front of the soldiers, there's what's called a hedgehog. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of anything from D-Day, but they're the big kind of jack-looking things that are designed to like stop tanks and boats from driving right up onto the sand. So then back to around the concrete, there are the seven educational boards. So on each one of the sides, there's the board about the beachhead. And then on the way in, the little concrete walkway in, there's one about the overview of what D-Day was, and then one about all the different special operations. So like the paratroopers, the different Army Ranger units, and like the glider units and things like that. Around all of this, then, there are four trees and four benches representing the four main attacking countries of the invasion. So there's one for France, Britain, Canada, and then the United States.
So this was not cheap. I mean, this cost some money. How much did it end up costing, and how did you raise that money?
There's two kind of parts to how much this ended up costing. So overall, the value of my project is listed at over $200,000. But specifically, the money that I had to fundraise for was about $42,000, which is the cost of the bronze statues. I was fortunate enough to go around to different businesses and enterprises in the community that were willing to donate the different aspects of my project to my efforts. So for example, the granite, it's a really rare type of granite called Pennsylvania Black. It only comes from this one quarry in Elverson, Pennsylvania, which is a little bit outside of Philly. I was given the idea by somebody in the community, and then I set up a meeting with them, and on the spot, because the granite quarry operator was an Eagle Scout and Marine himself, he donated all the granite for the project, which had a value of about $44,000. But for the specifically the fundraising part where I raised the funds for the statues, what I did was I went to the different American Legions and VFWs, and then also I talked to different local kind of community community businesses and things like that to fundraise. And I just went, I pitched them my project. I told them why I was doing my project, what my project was about. And when they see that, you know, young Americans are willing to honor this greatest generation, they're usually really pretty supporting and pretty wanting to be helpful. So, yeah.
I understand you did a lot of research and that you also met with some World War II vets, including some D-Day veterans. Tell me about that.
So for the research of my project, it wasn't something that was easy, obviously, because it's at the a government facility, specifically an army facility. They wanted everything to be, you know, their T's crossed and the dies or their I's dotted. So I had to do extensive research on all the seven educational boards. So those are all produced by me. I had to get different help from places like the National D-Day Memorial in Virginia, the National World War II Museum in Louisiana, and even international efforts like the Imperial War Museum in London, England. But what I did was I just kind of went through it. I tackled it. I found little different kind of stories and things like that to help people remember what D-Day was. And specifically, like you referenced, when I met with World War II veterans and specifically D-Day veterans, I was fortunate enough to be able to meet over, I believe it's 29 World War II veterans, and that's how many I was able to honor at the unveiling ceremony for my project. But I was able to interview some. Specifically, there's a man from a little bit outside of Lancaster. His name is Ray Wallace. He was 18 when he jumped into Normandy. He was a paratrooper with the 82nd Airborne Division. He had a really inspiring story for my project. And when I heard his story, it was kind of the defining moment that said, I can't, this isn't an option for me anymore. This is something that I have to do. So like I said, Mr. Wallace was 18 when he jumped into Normandy. His plane was being shot at and it actually exploded when, right after he jumped out. He landed 20 miles away from where he was supposed to be dropped in the small town of La Grenia in France. I was when I went to tour Normandy and do research for my project, I went and saw it. It, like I said, it's really small. It's a farming town. But he was there with about 300 to 400 other soldiers from all different ragtag units. These guys had never seen each other before. And so what ended up happening was the town was put under siege by a Nazi SS Panzer Grenadier Division. And so it was 3 or 4 days of kind of brutal fighting. And then when the Allied troops ran out of ammunition, ran out of things to fight with, they retreated out of the town. But the SS ended up killing the medics, the priests, the nuns. They burned down the church. They burned down the rest of the town. And unfortunately, Mr. Wallace was captured. After being sent to a German field hospital, he was then sent to a prisoner of war camp where he stayed for the rest of the year or for the rest of the war. And what really kind of shocked me about this is that he went into the service weighing about 168 pounds and he left the prison camp weighing 93. So it was really interesting to hear these guys' stories and understand what they went through at an age just a few years older than mine at the time. And so it was obviously really beneficial to hear that firsthand and be able to have that resonate with me. So,
well, Chris, congratulations. And I do admire that you are trying to memorialize the greatest generation, the people that fought in World War II. We're losing so many of them on a daily basis. I'm looking forward to seeing a Liberation Point. Want to move on to another Eagle Scout project. Casey Essick. Casey is 15. He researched 178 graves at the Mount Holly Springs Cemetery and found veteran gravestones that were missing military flag holders from members who served in seven wars, and took it upon himself to do something about it. Casey Essick, are you there?
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
I can. So, Casey, how did you get started? How did you get started on your project? How did you get the idea?
Well, every year, me and my troop, we've recently put it up to five, but we've been going to five different cemeteries for like Memorial Day and Veterans Day, and we put out the American flags to honor these people that have served in all the wars and provided our freedom. And we always have 100 or so left over out of the 200 that we had at the beginning. So I took on the task on seeing if I could find a few of the 100, and I found 178.
How did you find these grave sites? I mean, let's face it. I mean, you go back to the War of 1812. A lot of those tombstones, are very difficult to read. Are maybe there's not even a tombstone at all. So how did you find them?
Well, I had 11 teams, and we went into the different rows. Each row had two people in a team, and they all. We wrote down every grave or every gravestone, and then we went to a website called Find a Grave, and we typed in their name and where they were buried, and then we looked in their obituary if it said if they were a veteran or not, or if it said on the stone that they were a veteran, and if they were, then from what war.
Mm-hmm. But even going back to the War of 1812?
Yep.
In Find a Grave, you could find those graves for something from 200 years ago. So War of 1812, Civil War, Korean War, Spanish-American War, Vietnam, World War I, and World War II. So once you identified these grave sites, then what?
Well, then it was I went through and I marked to see if they already had a flag holder there. And if they didn't, then I marked which ones needed. So, for example, like which war they needed, and if they served in two wars, because they served in two wars, then they therefore got two flag holders. And at the very end, I would take all the names and all the flag holders that would be needed, and I would separate them. So how many GAR or how many GAR flag holders do I need? How many World War II I need? And I put them. So I wrote down however many I need from each one, and then I sent it off to the VFW, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Why was this important to you?
Well, I have a lot of family members that were in the military. Unfortunately, my great grandfather passed away in April of 2020, and he was in World War II. So after he passed away, I really wanted to get this done to make him proud. And my grandfather's been in the military. My uncle's been in the military. I've had a lot of people in the military.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the was this something that you were thinking about, the family members of those who survive? I mean, I think that if I had an ancestor that his grave wasn't marked, that I'd be happy for that to happen. And I don't know, it would bring some pride to it as well. I mean, where you think about the families as well.
Yeah, that is a big thing because I had a lady call me the other day, and she was very grateful that I did this. And this is only a small token of our appreciation that we could possibly do to equal up to the standards of the military that they provided.
Now, when you say that you had someone call you and say
yes,
that she appreciated it, tell me the story. Who was the ancestor? Tell me a little bit about it.
I don't know who she was. I don't know the name or who she was calling behalf of, but she was very grateful, and she said, "You have no idea how much this means to the families." Hmm. That someone, especially as young as me, was going out and appreciating the people from wars all the way back to 1812.
You know, something that Chris said a little bit earlier about your ages and people in your generation appreciating what their ancestors or the people that came before them went through. I mean, do you have that sense of history as well, that, this is something that you felt like you needed to do?
Yeah, because I look at it as back, all the way back in like World War II and stuff, they really because of what they did back then, we have the ability to do the stuff we do now. So like when you turn 18, most people now don't think about the military. No, we should, but they have the ability to do other things. Hmm. They have the abilities to go become doctors or something like that because we have the freedom now.
Hmm. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. And you both have become Eagle Scouts, and just becoming an Eagle Scout is something to be proud of, but both of you took on projects that will live on long after, you can talk about being an Eagle Scout, something that a lot of people can appreciate. Eagle Scouts Casey Essick of Mount Holly Springs and Christopher Adam of Mechanicsburg, thank you very much. And I have to say that I'm going to have to make a visit to to witness both of your projects, because I'm looking forward to that. But thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you again for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, it's good to see that we still do have, and it's not just young people, but people everywhere that are honoring those that came before them. And, again, I am looking forward to seeing both of these young men's projects. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good weekend.